On Wednesday, February 14th, another gunman walked into another school with another AR-15 assault rifle and murdered 17 more people. We recorded this episode before the news of the shooting broke, so you won't hear us discuss it this week. However, we wanted to point you to episode 4, which we recorded on November 8th. We spent the entire show talking about the statistics, the culture, and all sides of the gun debate, as well as the link between conservative evangelicalism and guns. We hope you'll give it a listen. In the meantime, our heartfelt prayers and all of our support go out to the victims' families, and our unending thanks goes to the teachers, administrators, all of the school employees, law enforcement, and emergency responders who did everything they could and who continue to do everything they can to keep our children safe. Take care of each other, friends. I'm Nish Wyseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we'll take up the case of Rob Porter, the former senior Trump aide who resigned after images emerged of some of the abuse his ex-wives suffered at his hands. Porter and his ex-wives are all members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and both women now say Mormon leaders discouraged them from reporting their abuse out of concern for Porter's career.
We'll also discuss plans for a progressive Christian revival in Lynchburg, Virginia, home of Liberty University, as well as the backlash it's inspired from conservative Christians. We are back after a week away because sometimes life is like that, listeners. And I'm almost scared to find out what rants Nish has stored up in that time. Twitter is still Nish-free, which means we're going to start with 3 minutes of Nish, in which she gets to do her best Lewis Black imitation about whatever it is she would have gotten out of her system if she was still unloading her thoughts 280 characters at a time. Nish, take it away.
Okay, here's my rant. Last week, Donald Trump released a document that is supposedly called a budget, but nothing in the document has any sort of realistic budget items, so like all of Donald Trump's promises that turn up empty, it's hard to take it seriously. But here's just a couple of batshit crazy items in the budget, which apparently exists in some sort of like parallel universe. Number one, it adds $777 billion to the military over the next 10 years. Did you know that we spend more on our military than the next 8 countries after us combined? It's insane. Number two, cutting $3 billion from the Education Department, including the DC Tuition Aid Program, which helps kids from DC be able to afford to go to college since DC isn't a state and there are no public universities in the district. Number three, it adds $1.6 billion for that stupid, stupid border wall that makes no sense. And wait, wasn't Mexico going to pay for that? Number four, it cuts the funding to the Department of Housing and Urban Development by 14%. Number five, it cuts funding for SNAP, or food stamps, by 27.4%. Number six, it cuts Medicaid and Obamacare subsidies by 22.5% by 2028. And number seven, it cuts the State Department budget by 26.9%. I could rant all the livelong day about this budget and how it's gross and immoral and leaves the country in a deeper fiscal hole, but I'm not going to do that. My rant and my question is to the people who continue to support this clown. He ran on populist promises. When he ran, he swore that he wasn't going to touch Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. But now he's gutting the programs of funding over the next 10 years. He promised he'd get jobs for blue-collar workers, but then he completely slashes funding that helps workers get jobs after losing them due to national disasters or factory closures. This a-hole repeatedly told you that he would, quote, balance the budget and very quickly, unquote. He told you he would eliminate the national debt by the end of his second term. But now the debt is going to grow by another $7 trillion over the next 10 years. And lastly, he's going to try to pay for all of those rich people tax cuts that he just gave them by destroying the safety net for the middle class and the poor. When will you open your eyes? When will you see that Donald Trump and his entire administration does not give a crap about you? He shows you time and time again, and now he just showed you again what he really thinks with this budget that will ultimately screw you if you're not already filthy rich. He is a liar and you keep falling for it. It is time to wake up. It's driving me insane. That's my rant. Let's move on.
Moving on to our first topic. There are a lot of things we could say about the fact that until last week, the White House staff secretary, arguably one of the most influential jobs in the West Wing, was a man many in the administration knew to be a serial domestic abuser. But for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to focus on the part of the story that intersects with a religious institution and its leaders, in this case, the Mormon Church. Rob Porter and his two ex-wives are all LDS members. Both women have now written and spoken about the fact that they each turned to men in the church for counsel after realizing they were married to an abuser. And in each case, church leaders told the women to consider the consequences for his career of reporting the abuse or otherwise bringing attention to their marriage. We're recording this episode on Tuesday, and just a few hours ago, BuzzFeed published a story based on the reports of nearly 24 other Mormon women who say they too went to church leaders after suffering abuse and were told to stay in their marriages.
Whew. There's a lot to say here. Like, there's so much to unpack. There's so many layers to this.
And it's just heartbreaking. We should start off. But
obviously. Like, there are so many different things to say. Like, number one, we could talk about, Sarah Huckabee Sanders and her getting up at the podium and like lying about whether or not the FBI knew or didn't know, whether the investigation was done or ongoing. Like, that's just like very, very, very tip top of the iceberg surface level stuff. But I know, Amy, you and I talked a little bit about the fact that this brings up, I think, a really interesting question. And I know I have experienced this. I'm sure you have experienced this. So many women around the world have experienced this in religious institutions, finding themselves in situations where they are having to confide in men. There are no women on staff. There are no women who hold leadership positions. There are no women who are pastors. There are no women who are elders. Women do not have authority in some of these religious institutions. And whether it's, you know, about abuse, whether it's about marriage counseling, or whether it's just about spiritual guidance, that there's no women. And that there are too many institutions around the world, religious institutions, where women, in some of their most vulnerable moments, where they should be able to go to the place that should be the safest, are not provided the opportunity to meet with an authority figure within that religious institution that is also a woman. And you and I talked about this a little bit, and it begs the question that are religious institutions that have strictly men-only authoritative structures, are they truly capable of serving the women in their congregations and serving the women that are in their communities? And it's really hard for me to say yes. I also know a lot of men who hold authority positions in several churches that are men only, and they're men of incredible integrity and character, who I love dearly. But the question still remains, would it be better? Would it be safer? Would it be more holistic and healthy if those authoritative structures also included women? And I emphatically believe yes. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's really hard for me to especially look at a situation like this where women were physically abused and to have them go to their spiritual leaders in this case and be met with an authoritative structure that is inherently going to probably lean more lenient towards other men. Man, that is just hard to read. It is hard to read. It's hard to hear. And you know, this isn't the only story. This happens a lot. And it's just, it's so hard.
We've discussed this enough just in the past few months. You know, there are unquestionably individual men who are absolutely capable of providing the right kind of sensitive, thoughtful guidance to individual women. Absolutely. And without question, there are individual women who, as religious leaders, might be incapable of providing that guidance to other women.
Yes, without question.
But
right.
When you have an institution that has, as most religious communities do, at least half and sometimes a majority of its members are women, and has in many cases no women in the leadership, you know, without knowing about each one of those individual cases, you know there are going to be problems. You know there will be blind spots that, you know, individual men who are capable of providing this sort of leadership and guidance are not going to be able to fill the needs of everybody who is in the community. And that is just a problem that, you know, I was thinking about this before we started talking today and thinking, well, you know, is it a matter of, would it have helped if there were some women in leadership positions? But then it gets you to, well, if it was the kind of religious community that had women in leadership positions, then it might not also have some of these other problems that lead to some of the really bad advice. I feel like in the past year and a half, I've become this person who just yells like, it's the patriarchy with everything. But it really is. And, you know, I don't want us to get much further before we note for listeners that in the Mormon church, traditionally, the local leaders are lay people. It would be your bishop who would be the one that you would go to. And these are folks who are leaders in their community, but are not trained as counselors or therapist, unless that's their professional training. But in their roles as church leaders, that's not guidance that they have gotten. So starting off, you're going to somebody who is going to be a man and also is not coming with training to recognize the signs of domestic abuse, who, even if somebody is self-reporting domestic abuse, isn't trained to know what to do about that. That is work that people are acknowledging has to be done with lay leaders in the Mormon church. But that said, these guys really let down Rob Porter's ex-wives.
Without question. I mean, just without question. And it's also important to note, like, because I do have a lot of Mormon friends. Obviously, I live here in Salt Lake City, that there is a leadership structure for women in the church, but they do not have any sort of disciplinary authority. And the people that you are always going to go to in the LDS church is going to be a man. It's going to be your bishop, but then he has two counselors. And then you've got, you know, your councils and all that kind of stuff that happens within like a regional structure, a stake structure. So all of the congregations kind of in one area. There's a whole like hierarchy of authoritative structure in the Mormon church all the way up to the first presidency and the disciplinary line. So the ability to enact discipline within the church is only given to men. And so it doesn't matter how high up you go. you could have jumped over your bishop to your stake president. You could have gone, you know, if you really wanted to, but it wouldn't matter. Like, you would still be going to men. Men only are given that authoritative position. And like what you were saying, there are good men. There really are. But the problem is systemic. And we can't let like the like, okay, yes, there are good men who would do the right thing, who would report this and who would, you know, obviously do what was needed in this situation. Of course, there are men out there that do that. But when a whole structure is built around the narrative, perspective, and framework of one gender, and it is the gender that in these sorts of abuse situations already has the power, you're looking at an inherent power dynamic imbalance that will always put women back on their heels and that will always put women in a position where they are not given, I don't want to say the respect, but they're not given maybe the seriousness, I guess, that they deserve. And women will have to always in these sorts of structures fight harder to be heard, to fight harder to be taken seriously. If in nowhere in the authoritative structure are there other women, just looking at the sheer numbers of, in this case, domestic abuse, you know, let's set aside harassment, sexual abuse, the hashtag Me Too movement, all of that, just straight up domestic abuse, like what we're seeing with the Rob Porter case, just the sheer numbers, the statistics are overwhelming. That by even if you made half of your leadership structure women, the probability that you would have other women in your leadership structure who have also experienced domestic abuse is likely. And so you're putting women who have experienced this particular thing and have an eye to identify it in a position of authority, which would then help victims of, you know, all different areas of abuse, but specifically looking at this case, domestic abuse. You're going to have women in authoritative structures who can provide that counsel and who can provide that perspective and who can report as necessary. And these sorts of things.
And who understand the dynamics.
Who understand the dynamics.
That play into domestic abuse, who are not going to jump as this BuzzFeed piece.
Right.
One of the most heartbreaking things.
Gosh.
Example after example of women being told, and it feels like, is this the 1950s, that they must have brought it upon themselves? Like, what were they doing wrong that their husbands were abusing them?
Right. I mean, it's beyond heartbreaking. It's enraging, and it's, frankly, it's gross. It's sickening. It makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Just makes me nauseous thinking about it. But yeah, I mean, putting women in positions of authority in these sorts of situations, there is just an inherent power dynamic balance that happens when a woman is in the room. And I've actually been in conversations with men who, you know, sit on elder boards or, you know, who are part of a men-only pastor team. And they say things like, well, when you put a woman, you know, in the room, it completely changes the dynamic of the room. And I look at them and I'm like,
yeah,
good. It should. That's super important. Like the fact that it is an inherently male dominated room and it feels like the oxygen got sucked out of the room when a woman walks in is actually a good thing. Like that is not an inherently bad thing. What you're telling me right now is a compliment. It's not a complaint. So even just those values.
Yeah, I don't want to compare them to Steve Bannon, but you may have seen his comments over.
No, I didn't.
Well,
thank God.
Reported over the weekend of, well, he's reflecting on the Me Too movement and the reckoning. And yeah, so building this up as, you know, he tends to be a little hyperbolic. So talking about this is 10,000 years of human history we're changing here, and you know it's going to be enormous. Like, yeah, we hope so.
I mean, if we're looking at 10,000 years of human history, my answer is, well, I guess it's about damn time. Like, you know, like, of course. And also, hallelujah, amen, and good night, congregation. Like, that is what I have to say.
But imagine saying that and thinking that's a bad thing.
Right. Like, oh, gross. Just gross. But I mean, of course, it's Steve Bannon. What else do you expect?
So I have a question for you here, because, and I will acknowledge, while Nish is for now our senior Salt Lake City correspondent for the non-Daily Show Impolite Company, she is not an LDS member or an authorized spokesperson, but you are our LDS adjacent person. So I know that this particular case is complicated by the fact that there are beliefs in the LDS Church about the family and about the role that a husband and a father has, particularly, that kind of up the stakes in terms of how bad things have to be before you can get out of your marriage, and specifically the idea of the priesthood, which is not just in this lifetime, in this form, but eternal.
Yes. The power of God given to man. Correct.
Yes. Now that, it seems to me, is part of the kind of talking past each other that must have occurred in these instances where women were going to the male leaders in their church and talking about what's happening to them right now. And the men are responding really with their eye more on the priesthood for that family. I mean, does that seem fair?
Yes. Yes, it does. The interesting dynamic to this is, yes, there, I mean, there is an inherent centrality to the traditional family unit. Let me make sure I clarify that. We're talking about one man, one woman, and children is what they would consider, quote unquote, the family or the family unit. And the understanding of the family and the understanding of a husband and a wife coming together, I'm looking here at what's called the family proclamation, or the family, a proclamation to the world. And this was given during the presidency of Gordon B. Hinckley. And it is essentially, it kind of lays out the values and the centrality of the family and the centrality of a husband and wife marriage. And let me see, it says right here, essentially that the husband and a wife, like there are different roles. The husband leads the family in his role as priesthood holders. He's the one that has the authority, all of that kind of stuff. And when you take out the role of the priesthood out of the family unit, right? So if you take out the husband, all of a sudden the wife and the children are left without, you know, the power of the priesthood in their family. A lot of times that would come under like the ex-wife at that point, her father. So there's all sorts of different kind of structural things that happen within the power of the priesthood. But the proclamation here is clear. And the church in its doctrinal teaching about abuse has actually been pretty clear. And in the family, a proclamation to the world, it says here, we warn that individuals who violate covenants of chastity, who abuse spouse or offspring, or who fail to fulfill family responsibilities will one day stand accountable before God. And in LDS terms, that's a big deal. You will account for what you have done. And they have spoken out about if you are a priesthood holder in your family and you abuse your wife or your child, like you're not honoring the power of the priesthood. You are abusing that power and you shouldn't hold it. Like you are not honoring it. And several teachers in the church have been very, very clear about that. And so it is creating this really interesting dynamic. Just talking with my LDS neighbors and friends here and some people that are authority structures in the church, or a part of the authority structure in the church, listening to them kind of talk about it and go, this is, you know, asking some pretty significant questions of the church to say, where's the breakdown here, right? Where is this authority structure failing? something isn't right if more and more of these report. I mean, like just this BuzzFeed article today, like, I mean, if there's 12 women just in this one BuzzFeed article, we're looking at potentially dozens, hundreds more.
And I have to highlight part of the article where they talk to a woman who is herself Mormon, and she's a prosecutor at the Salt Lake District Attorney's Office. And this quote just, man, like I know that's in the church's teaching, and there's obviously no encouragement of abuse, but she says, as a prosecutor, I've seen bishops many times come in and speak on behalf of defendants in domestic abuse cases. I have never seen one talk in support of victims, never in 26 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Like I said, the connection to power is strong. No, in any religious community, in any power, in any authority structure, whether it's religious or not, the powerful will protect the powerful. And that is not how it should go. The powerful should protect the vulnerable. And it is a gross abuse of power. It is a gross abuse of authority to not stand with victims of abuse. No matter which way you slice it, no matter which type of abuse we're talking about, no matter which type of power structure we're discussing, whether it's religion, government, business, Hollywood, you name it. It is a gross misuse of power. And it's just so sad. It is so, so sad. And it makes you wonder, like, what is it going to take to change it? Now, in the Mormon church, I will say that because of the doctrine of the priesthood, that only men are allowed to be given that power, that only men can hold that power, there has to actually be theological and doctrinal change.
Right. Well, same thing in the Catholic Church.
Same thing in the Catholic Church. And frankly, in some, you know, more conservative evangelical churches, we're looking, I mean, there's a whole host of different religious structures that adhere to a patriarchal system based on their theology.
That's hard. That's not a matter of like hiring more women to be studio heads in Hollywood.
No, this is not a personnel shift. We have to fundamentally, and in the Mormon church, this is a big deal. This has been talked about in previous years when the ordained women movement happened in the LDS church with Kate Kelly, who wanted to see women be given the priesthood. But it fundamentally goes against core doctrine of the church, like core doctrine, where if you pull one pin out, the whole thing almost falls over. And so like you're talking about significant theological restructure and from the ground up. And when you've got a church of now 15 million people that has been operating under these, you know, pretty much the same theological underpinnings for, you know, the last over 100 years since the LDS church was founded. I mean, that's a big shift. That's just not going to happen because some women came forward with allegations of abuse, unfortunately, right? I mean, this is turning a giant freighter on a dime is what you're asking to do, which, I mean, I'm not saying is impossible, but you're asking people to change their belief system, truly. And that's different.
It's true. Okay, well, before we move on to our next topic, I guess one question it raises for me is, for women who are in these religious communities, who do they go to? I mean, is their move to turn to somebody for counsel and advice who's outside their faith tradition, because that may be the only way that they find somebody who can give them kind of more objective advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, my inclination is always no matter which faith tradition you're a part of, no matter which religious structure, what your religious structure looks like in your community, the first thing in these sorts of instances is you need to find like a clinical counselor. Because as much as spiritual advice is good and healthy and a part of the process, even pastors who are trained in quote unquote counseling, a lot of them are not clinical or licensed social workers that can provide the type of, you know, therapy that is needed. And I think a lot of people go first to their church for that type of counseling. And I always counsel people to say, no, you need to go find a therapist. That is also different. The other reason being is that I'm pretty sure across 50 states, I'm going to have to fact check this, but therapists are mandatory reporters. And especially in issues of child abuse. And so they are held to a standard that pastors and church leaders aren't necessarily across the board. And so that's always my like first go-to is to say, like, if you are experiencing abuse of any kind, you need to go find a therapist, you need to report it, and then go from there. And then loop in your faith community once you're getting, you know, pretty significant help.
Well, then, Nish, in a future episode, we are going to need to take on the issue of how mental health is viewed in a lot of religious communities. Because
oh, you're going to need to give me a couple months. Yeah. As someone who lives with mental health issues, I have, whoo boy, have I got some things to say. But all that to say, yeah, I think that there does need to be a little bit more open-mindedness, open-handedness to say, this structure, or, you know, going to a group of men about my spousal abuse, like if you're not comfortable with it, then don't do it. And go somewhere else. It's okay. Like I think we always feel like we're locked in to a situation when we have freedom, in more freedom than we think. Now, obviously when you're in an abusive relationship, there are dynamics there, that you have to be careful of, but yeah, I mean, to answer your question, I think yes, like there has to be, if there's not going to be those sort of big kind of structural shifts, then we have to have a keen eye. Yeah, there have to be alternatives. And it's important to everyone, especially to women who are experiencing abuse, that we start making those places known. Because I think a lot of people don't know, like, which churches have women that they can go talk to. Those things are not always made public and easily accessible. And so that's super important. And so I think just making those places more visible would be a good step in the right direction. So our other main topic this week is a progressive Christian revival. Ooh, using my language, that organizers describe as a, quote, critique of toxic evangelicalism, unquote. I'm already excited. I am on board. Sign me up. Take all my money. It's scheduled to take place the week after Easter in Lynchburg, Virginia, which, if you've been paying attention to Impolite Company, is not a coincidence. The revival is the brainchild of activist Shane Claiborne, who leads the group Red Letter Christians, and who has been publicly asking Liberty University President Jerry Falwell Jr. to debate evangelicalism for a while now, to no avail, and much to my dismay. Shane will be joined by other progressive leaders, including Reverend William Barber, Lisa Sharon Harper, and Tony Campolo. I am kind of wanting to book a plane ticket to Virginia, Amy.
I know.
we have some, you know, good friends in the pod squad who are going to be there, which is kind of exciting. So yeah, we'll have to make our way out to the East Coast, but this is exciting.
Yeah. You know, Shane, has some good quotes about this already, including it's not a coincidence that we're there, but we're not there just to like hold a 3-day shame Jerry Falwell Jr. event, Although, frankly,
I'm not opposed to
it. I would be there for that as well.
We're such assholes.
But listen to this. He says, we're not there to vilify Jerry Falwell. We're there to lift up Jesus. And that itself is the critique of toxic evangelicalism. So, boom.
I like it. I like it. I mean, by lifting up Jesus, it's hard not to also simultaneously put down Jerry Falwell Jr. But that's neither here nor there. I'm really excited. I think that something like this is needed. I think that there are a lot of people, and I know Shane speaks to these folks, we speak to these folks, there are a lot of people who would identify themselves as more progressive, who also evangelicalism is part of their faith heritage, and it's part of who they are, it's part of their identity, and it's hard to shake. And I think a lot of us are out here going like, man, we just like, where are our people? Right? Like, where are our people? Where are our leaders? In the same way that, like, you know, the conservative demographic has their Falwells, they have their, you know, Pat Robertsons and their Johnny Moores and their, you know, whoever else is preaching out there these days. But like, who are the people that are these, you know, strong faith leaders on the left? And they have been there for a really long time, but I think that something like this would do wonders for the more religious left to have almost like a, I don't say like a gathering space, but almost like a collective to say like, oh no, these are our people. These are, you know, the people that are out here leading that I hadn't necessarily heard of before, or that I've been wanting to see all together, or, you know, these are the, you know, ethic points that I align with, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I think it's good.
There are certainly occasions. I'm thinking of the Wild Goose Festival, the Y Christian Conference, which is coming up in March. But and not knocking those at all, because they definitely have their place and value. But this is the kind of like badass move that the religious left is not really known for, to put it gently.
To put it in Liberty's backyard.
Yeah. And it's the type of thing that, you know, that the right, frankly, has been doing for decades. And I've wondered for years, you know, we know when it's coming up, things like the Values Voters Summit. I've always wondered why progressive Christians didn't like counter program that, because every journalist in town has to cover it. And we know what they're going to be there saying. So it seems like an obvious obvious point. But here they are stepping up. And I was interested in this because it's happening, but also because it's poking the bear. And so I wanted to see what was going to come of it. Jerry Falwell has not commented publicly. He's actually blocked me from Twitter, so I have a hard time following what he's saying.
What? How did you get blocked?
I don't know. I'm kind of shocked it didn't happen a long time ago, but I'm not sure exactly.
I'm going to order you a trophy. What it was. I'm ordering you a trophy. I'm going to have it delivered to your house. That's amazing.
Well, the thing is, you can just like go on Twitter, not under an account, and see what he's saying. But whatever.
Are you bitter that I'm not on Twitter right now?
So I did see that he retweeted a column that was on Town Hall. And I haven't heard of this dude, so I'm not even going to mention him, his name. But it... I'll read the headline because, oh, these guys love themselves. Calling good evil and evil good, how Christian liberals, and that's in quotes, twist the words of Jesus to wage war against President Trump, part one. So, man, I am on pins and needles waiting for part two of this one. But I just wanted to give you a taste of it because it's just so obnoxious. And yet, I think it is useful because for me, it has kind of highlighted something that I didn't even realize I had accepted as kind of a stereotype of liberal Christians. And so I want to make sure that I'm not falling into this going forward. And I also think that we could find some use in grappling with the fact that some of these guys in the religious right have spent decades really making ideas conventional wisdom that keep people trapped, I think, in churches and religious communities where they feel uncomfortable. So just backing up for a second, this guy, he's apparently thrown by the idea that Christian liberals exist, and keeps saying throughout this that apparently, yes, this is a thing, not an oxymoron, and is, thrown by the idea that you can call yourself a Christian and say that you love Jesus and yet follow an agenda that's not the same as the religious right. And he's got a great argument here that red letter Christians, if your positions are so godly, why do so many non-Christians agree with them? Back up for a second. So his argument is to take a truly Christian position on something, everybody else is going to think you're wrong. Everybody. There's no such thing as a just inherently right and moral position to hold, that unless it is completely countercultural and everybody stands against you, you know it's somehow compromised and tainted. So that's where this dude is coming from. But it basically, it falls into the genre of what, again, as I said, we have seen for decades, which is painting anybody to the left of the religious right, frankly, as theologically compromised and wanting that, you know, if you leave our church, if you leave our fold, if you leave our political camp, you are going to be compromising your spiritual life and perhaps your soul, because you're going to throw yourself in with folks who have watered down their theology, who don't care about Jesus, who don't care about doctrine, and who are basically inseparable from completely secular folks. And I'll admit that there are some places within the Christian world where the way they approach theology is not quite the way I would prefer. In my book, I think I poked fun at an Episcopal church I used to attend, because on Easter Sunday one year, the rector stood up and said something to the effect of, "I know not everybody here believes in the resurrection." And I just thought, dude, okay, there is room for people being at different stages in their spiritual journeys. But on Easter, you should at least like presume that all of us here are here because we believe in the resurrection, or at least like pretend that that's the case. And it is, but you know what? Now I think I would have worded it differently. I think he should have said something more along the lines of, I know not everybody has gotten here yet to thinking about the resurrection in real terms, acknowledging that some people feel more comfortable thinking about it as a metaphor, but not making it a we, you know, that not everybody here is going to think that this core piece of what makes us Christians is real and is something that we can believe. And yet, for the most part, when these conservative guys come after liberal Christians, it's not on matters of theology. It's on matters of interpretation. And what really just gets me is, for ever, they have completely ignored, say, the existence of the Black church, where you've got folks who hold very doctrinaire positions and who are very serious and orthodox about their theology and who come to often very different conclusions about what the Bible requires of Christians and what our priorities need to be. Ignore the existence of a lot of Latin Christians, of our Asian brothers and sisters in the church. But also, you know, there are a lot of progressive white Christians who are very serious about their religion. They just read the Bible differently, and they come to different conclusions than the conservative dudes. It's not a matter of being less serious about their Christianity. It's a matter of reading it differently and having different lenses. And I am just now so offended in retrospect for the last 30 or 40 decades that they have been hammering home this argument. And it really does make me feel for folks who, especially over the past year, are feeling torn as Christians and not feeling comfortable where they are, and yet who have been, it is kind of like an abusive relationship. They've been told, I'm the one who's best for you, and you can't leave for me because you don't know what's out there. They will not care for your soul, and you will be basically, you know, throwing yourselves to the wolves to leave these doors and try to find another home.
Yeah. One of my favorite things to do, I've been in more theological debates with dude bros. And one of my favorite things to do is this phrase will always come up. Always.
Bible's
always.
So not
doesn't
clear.
Matter what the issue. Well, the Bible is clear, right? Which is enraging all in its own right, because the Bible is not clear on pretty much anything. Like, on literally anything. It's super convoluted and complicated. But my favorite thing to do when people say,
not to mention,
well,
contradictory.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Let's, we could go on and on. But someone will throw out, well, the Bible is clear. And my favorite thing to respond with is, I always interrupt, which I try not to do, but I always interrupt. And I say, no, no, no. Your interpretation of the Bible is clear. And that always kind of puts them back on their heels, because it reminds them that, like, oh no, oh, that's right. We are all coming to this with our own interpretation. We're all coming to it with our own lenses, with our own academic study, with our own history, like all of the things that you approach any work. Like, you don't read a novel objectively either. We certainly don't come to scripture objectively. There is no such thing as an objective reading of scripture. P.S. But yeah, to like remind them that, oh, that's right. Like, ultimately, this is my interpretation, or this is the interpretation of the party of which I ascribe to, or the theological camp, or whatever, however you want to frame that. But the Bible in and of itself and how we read it is incredibly complicated. It has been complicated since the beginning of time, since it was written. People have been debating about what it says. And to say the Bible is clear, or to therefore assume that someone else is not taking the Bible seriously or is not taking their faith seriously, is so condescending. It makes me wonder, and as someone who is more progressive in my theology, it also puts me back on my heels a little bit too, frankly, just to be honest. Like, it helps me remain humble, and it helps me keep my hands open a little bit to go, oh no, like, even I have shifted on some things, and I am growing, and I am still learning. And the older I get, the less I know. And I could probably do a lot better at assigning positive intent on the other side as well. And to say, they are hopefully, just like I am, approaching the text and approaching my faith seriously and with faith and with honesty and humility, and to say, okay, they just land somewhere else. It doesn't mean they don't take it less seriously than I do. It doesn't mean that they love Jesus any less than I do. They just interpret it differently. And the more we can assign positive intent with each party, not political party, but with each theological, you know, group, I guess, I wonder how much better off we'll all be. And to your question, I want to go back. You had this point of saying, like, or you had this question of, like, I've been wondering when the progressive religious groups or the, you know, Christian left would start employing, I don't want to say some of the same tactics that the right has used, but, like, when will the religious left start to coalesce in the same way that the religious right has done? And I don't...
Well, go on offense more than
defense. Go on offense. And...
say, so we've got a strong, robust Christianity, and we are proud of
yes. And right. And I wonder if the problem really is twofold. And I wonder if, number one, there is, which we have talked about at length on the podcast before, and it is a subject that Democrats need to tackle, frankly, is the unwillingness of Democrats to openly talk about faith and to go after voters of faith and to couch some of these issues within a faith lens, to reach across and try to get more voters. Like, I think that there is an inherent unwillingness on the Democratic Party to do that, which the Christian left aligns more closely with those values. And so there's a disconnect there from the party and the leaders of the religious left. In a way that there isn't with the conservative and the Republicans. There's obviously a very unhealthy marriage there that has been happening for the last 30 years. And so that brings me to my second point, is I wonder if there is a wariness also on behalf of these religious left leaders who are unwilling to intertwine themselves in with the Democratic Party or with any political party for fear of becoming the exact same thing that they are saying is really unhealthy and toxic on the conservative side. We're just going to be the liberal version of it. And the minute that you intertwine yourselves inherently with a political party is the minute that maybe you compromise some of your ability to maneuver. And also it, you know, makes you, you know, just a part of the machine in the same way that Falwell and Franklin Graham and those guys are a part of the conservative party, you know, the Republican Party. They're part and parcel of the same thing. I wonder if there's a reluctance on behalf of some of these religious left leaders to really engage on a party level. And so there's been a disconnect there, I think, from both sides on the left, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there definitely is. But, you know, what's different about this is it's not partisan. It's not political. It is it's intra-faith warfare, basically. To be totally honest, Democrats would do well to take some interest in it, but, they would have to recognize that there are evangelicals who are progressive, so they will not. And that's, we've talked enough about that. All right. So we have come to the end, and to wrap up the show every week, we like to leave you with a recommendation, a TV show, a movie, maybe some music. Nish, what do you have for us this week? I know you've been busy.
Well, I have been busy. News to all of the podcast listeners, if you haven't followed me on social media, we're moving. Wyseth family is moving to Idaho.
Idaho what?
A little town 90 miles north of Boise, Idaho. Is what we're calling it. Yeah, we're moving to a little town north of Boise called McCall. It's a little tourist mountain town that has two ski resorts and a giant lake where everyone goes boating, and it's dreamy and amazing. And my husband and I have been dreaming about moving there since we were married, and so we have the opportunity to go, and we're going, which is crazy. Anyway, all that to say,
prepare the guest room.
Yes, absolutely. Come visit anytime. But so I haven't watched a lot of TV or movies or listened to music. I really haven't done much with myself aside from selling my house. But there are things happening this week that I am looking forward to. So I'll just go ahead and say, hey, this is what I'm going to be doing this week. Number one, we are recording this on Tuesday evening. Tomorrow on Wednesday on Netflix, for the first time in 10 years, Chris Rock is debuting new stand-up on Netflix, his first one since 10 years ago. And it's called The Tambourine, I think is what it's called. Let me look it up. But anyway, I'm a huge Chris Rock fan. Love Chris Rock. Back from, just his SNL days. I mean, he is just brilliant. He's one of the more prolific comedians in generations. And so I love him. His voice, just hearing him talk, like as soon as his voice comes on the radio, like he just inherently makes me laugh. I love him so much. So really looking forward to Chris Rock's stand-up on Netflix. That's number one. And number two, Amy, it is Black Panther week. Black Panther is being released in movie theaters this week. I am a superhero movie geek. I love them all. And when Black Panther made his debut in The Avengers a few years back, I almost came out of my skin. I was so excited. And then it was made known that they are going to make an entire film about the Black Panther, one of my favorite characters in comic books. So I am so excited. The reviews are coming in and they are all just incredible. So my husband is not a huge superhero movie fan, aside from the Christopher Nolan Batman series. So I am going to be dragging him, I think, to the movie theater because our new town in Idaho does not have a movie theater. So we're going to try to pack in all the movies that we can see before we leave. And one of them is Black Panther. So I am hoping to go see it Thursday night. So I will report back if I go see it on what I think. But I am already kind of resolving myself to love it because it's just going to be so good. And the soundtrack is amazing. It's got a lot of Kendrick Lamar, who I love. So that is what I'm doing this week. Amy, what do you have? We have some fun news in Pod Squad land.
We do. And we will be bringing some of our Pod Squatters. That doesn't sound quite right.
No, we can't call them Pod Squatters.
No, we'll be bringing some of the Pod Squad. In future episodes, maybe later this month, definitely some in March. Our friend Kate Bowler is a rock star. Her book
is amazing.
Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved came out last week. It sold out on Amazon within 3 days.
She is crushing.
It is currently number 4 on Amazon, not like 4 in some little mini subcategory, number 4 entirely. She was on Terry Gross on Fresh Air this week, and you should all listen to that for a little preview. But I want her to come on and talk to us during Lent, because one of my very favorite parts of her book is a chapter on Lent, and she's so funny, but you can kind of, it's tempting to miss sometimes in the humor, the serious points that she's making. And she really just, it's a gut punch, this one, about why Christians are so eager to race through Holy Week to get to Easter and just refuse to sit with death and grief and just want to get to He is Risen, which is an exciting time of the year. It's the holiest time of the year for us, but there are things that come before that. So I want to bring her on to talk with us. Because she is an overachiever, she has also launched a podcast on which she talks to all sorts of awesome people. Up first is Nadia Boltz-Weber. And then I think she's got another episode this week. And our friend as well, Deborah Jane Lee, has a podcast called Kaleidoscope. And Debbie is a fantastic journalist. She is doing really deeply reported stories, trying to lift up the faith stories of people you don't normally hear from. And you are going to definitely want to listen, to subscribe, and to check in with her. And then last but not least, other Pod Squad member Michelle Higgins, who is on Truth Table. She is one third of Truth Table, but she is 100% in our hearts. That's the lamest slogan ever. But her podcast is really just a shot to the heart. And they are back for their second season. And all of this happened like in the last week. So I've got a lot of podcasts to listen to, and will be making sure that I'm subscribed to all three of those. But also wanted to recommend, while you are looking forward to Chris Rock, we actually got ourselves out of the house to see an actual comedy show. We went
look at you guys,
John Mulaney, a couple weeks ago.
What?
Who? Oh my goodness! I had forgotten. It feels so good to laugh so hard that you are crying, and I basically cried for an hour.
Where did you see him? Did you see him in the city?
He was at the Chicago Theater, which is this old historic theater. It's gorgeous, and when you turn the block, you come around and there is just the huge sign going up. And I will admit, I was a little worried because it says like John Mulaney, Kid Gorgeous. And then underneath it says Paw Patrol Live. It's like, this could be either the most fantastic evening or this could go very, very wrong. And it turns out Paw Patrol Live was just like promoting something that was going to happen later in the month, which thank God.
Paw Patrol and Live is coming here too.
Tell my children that there is such a thing as Paw Patrol Live, I will cut you. You're not going to.
I second that. We are not either. It is coming here after we move, and I can't. I will not break my daughter's heart. I can't do it. And if any of you break my daughter's heart, I will.
Mum's the word.
Destroy you.
But anyway, just when the inevitable Kid Gorgeous stand-up special comes out,
yes,
you must watch it.
Okay.
Among all of the very, very funny things is he ends with a long bit about Catholic dads who sing off-key, and he just does a wonderful off-key rendition of, if you have ever gone to a more contemporary Catholic mass, you will be familiar with all these songs. And it really just gave me joy.
Oh, good.
Joy, joy, joy.
Down in your heart.
Down in my heart.
You're welcome.
Have you, if you were here.
I am sorry, and you're welcome. That is what I have to say. Well, that's a good note to end on. That is all for this week's episode. Thank you for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It is the very best way to let other people know about us and to expand these conversations. And as always, we will post the show notes on our Facebook page, Impolite Company, the podcast. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.